Today, risk on, risk off. The Property Imperative Weekly to the 7th of September 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In this week's digest of the recent events, we look at the latest from the Federal Reserve, recent movements in the markets, and locally, the implications of this week's weak GDP outturn at a time when home prices continue to rebound, at least in places. And in a week when we got significant media coverage on a range of important issues, and we also took some flack from some who prefer to play the man, not the ball. But we continue regardless. As usual, we'll start with the international markets, but if you want to jump to the Australian segment, the code is shown below, and in the comments, we list the main topics covered today. The US markets moved just a little higher on Friday, with mixed data from the US jobs report, the strong expectation that a Federal Reserve interest rate cut will happen this month, and more stimulus from China eased some of the worries about the trajectory of global growth. Through the week, the market turned positive as news that the US-China trade talks are set to resume in earnest next month, though White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow suggested it would take some time to get a trade deal with China, so don't expect an instant result. US jobs growth slowed more than expected in August, with retail hiring declining for a seventh straight month, as the Labor Department's non-farm payroll data showed that the economy added 130,000 jobs in August. That's below expectations of around 158,000. The employment figure would have been lower, except for 25,000 workers put on the government payroll to prepare for the 2020 census. While average hourly earnings gained 0.4% last month, in the largest increase since February, the annual increase dipped to 3.2% from 3.3% in July, and this will still support US consumer spending, which of course accounts for around 7% of the economy, and this is signalling that the US economy is expanding moderately, despite concerns relating to the ongoing trade tensions. Also on Friday, speaking at the University of Zurich, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said that the labour market was strong and the central bank will continue to act as appropriate to sustain economic expansion.
The United States economy has continued to perform well and is in a good place. In fact, we're well into the 11th year of this expansion, which began back in the second half of 2009. It's now the longest such expansion since we began keeping reliable records. And the outlook, the most likely outlook for our economy, remains a favorable one, with moderate growth, a strong labor market, and inflation moving back up close to our 2% goal. All that said, there are significant risks, and we've been monitoring those, including, as you mentioned, slowing global growth, uncertainty around trade policy, and also persistently low inflation. I'll just make a couple of quick comments on that. Mm-hmm. I think we grew at about 2.5% in the first half of the year. For the year, we'll be somewhere between 2 and 2.5%. That's very much driven by consumer spending, which represents 70% of our economy. Consumer has been strong. The service sector has been strong. The manufacturing, trade, and business investment side has been weaker and is, in fact, now sideways to slightly down. It's a smaller part of the economy, and by the way, that pattern of a strong consumer economy and a weaker manufacturing, investment, and trade economy is fairly common now around the world. Meanwhile, our labor market is in quite a strong position. We're, for a year and a half, we've been at half-century lows in unemployment. We've got higher labor force participation. We've got wages moving up by so many measures. The labor market is in a good place. I think today's labor market report is very much consistent with that story. And we've got inflation moving back up to 2%. So overall, we're in a good place, and the outlook is good as well. I think part of the reason the outlook is good is that the Fed has, through the course of the year, seen fit to lower the expected path of interest rates. That has supported the economy. That's one of the reasons why the outlook is still a favorable one, despite these crosswinds they've been facing. So you asked specifically about global growth. The global economy has been slowing since the middle of, let's say, 2018. We see that continuing with China and Germany and the EU. There are many factors that are driving that. Trade policy uncertainty is one of them, but it's not the only one. But trade policy uncertainty will be weighing on business investment decisions and that sort of thing. So still, though, I'll just wrap up by saying we see the most likely case for the U.S. and for the world, too, as continued moderate growth. And as, at the FOMC, we're going to, as we move forward, we're going to continue to watch all of these factors and all the geopolitical things that are happening, and we're going to continue to act as appropriate to sustain this expansion.
And his remarks followed the usual tweets from President Trump calling for deep rate cuts when the Fed's Federal Open Markets Committee meets on September 17, 18. But Powell stressed the Fed is independent of such pressure.
Political factors play absolutely no role in our process, and my colleagues and I would not tolerate any attempt to include them in our decision-making or our discussions. That's not our DNA. Our DNA is what I mentioned earlier. We're strongly committed to non-political decision-making. We serve all Americans, regardless of their political party. And it's just simply wrong. The idea that we would deviate from that is just simply wrong. And so the answer would be a hard no, let's say.
Oh, and he underscored the risk relating to Libra and said that it needed to be addressed before any significant rollout.
You know, of course, we're following very carefully the whole question of digital currencies. It's not something that we're actively considering, other central banks more than we are. And for us, it raises substantial, significant issues that we'd want to see, you know, carefully resolved. For example, you know, if you think about one a currency that was for the United States or for, frankly, a multinational currency, it would really need to be cyber secure because, I mean, it's one thing to be able to counterfeit paper currency. It's another thing to be able to hack into a cyber currency and create with a computer however much of it you want. So the cyber issues are quite daunting. It's also not clear to us that there's really demand for this. So, you know, consumers have plenty of payment options. They're not clamoring for this. I don't want to sound like I'm ruling it out, but I think there really are. There's another question, too, which is if people are leaving their money in a cyber currency and holding it there, they're not putting it in a bank. What happens with banks is people deposit their money and banks lend the money out. So what will happen to intermediation, the whole intermediation process? What will happen if everyone's just, you know, investing in this cyber currency? So I would say, look, we're in favor of financial innovation. We're following these things very carefully, but we don't see digital currencies from a central bank as something happening in the near term. So I want to start again by saying that, you know, we do want to see responsible financial innovation. We think that's key. We think that will enable people to be better served and drive costs out of the system. So it's important that we be open to that. I think, as I've said before about Libra, with Facebook's very large network of more than a couple billion people, a stable coin could be systemically important very quickly if it were to have wide adoption, and that's not a foregone conclusion. But because of that, we would think that Libra would need to be held to the highest standards. It could be systemically important right away, potentially. And because of that, it would have to be held to the highest regulatory and supervisory expectations. It is not obvious to see how that would happen under our current regulatory system. So it's the kind of thing where we've said this is not going to be a sprint to implementation. This is going to be a careful, thoughtful conversation about how we can do our job of protecting the public from cyber risk and all the other risks that come with something this systemically important.
At the close in New York, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 0.26% to hit a new one-month high, ending at 26,797, while the S&P 500 index added 0.09% to close at 2,978, and the Nasdaq Composite declined 0.17% to 8,103. The Nasdaq Composite slipped to a small loss at the end of the day because of a weakness in Amazon, down 0.39% to 1,833, and Apple, down to 213.26. Tech stocks, of course, are heavily exposed to China. Stocks had soared on Wednesday and Thursday on news that the US and Chinese negotiators expect to meet next month in Washington. The volatility index was down a substantial 7.81% to 15.92 and down more than 40% from the start of the year. The major averages finished higher for a second straight week. The S&P 500 was up 1.8% on the week, and the Dow added 1.5% and the Nasdaq was up 1.76%. Energy shares moved up as West Texas Intermediate crude moved up to $56.70 a barrel, ending the week up 2.9%, and gold moved lower, down 0.67% and closing at $1,526, while silver slid 2.88% to $1,874. US Treasuries fell in price and the yields rebounded from multi-year lows as investors moved out of safe assets into equities. The 10-year Treasury yield was 1.559%, up from a 3-year low of 1.428% in midweek, when soft economic data and Sino-US trade worries stoked global recession concerns. In fact, a decline in interest rates on long-term US government bonds below the average stock dividend yield has received less attention than an inverted Treasury yield curve, but this could be another reason why stocks moved up a little. After the S&P 500 suffered its first monthly drop since May, partly because the Treasury yield curve inversion is seen by many as a harbinger of recession, equities were off to a solid start in September, historically their worst month of the year. This uncommon Treasury bond dividend yield inversion is providing a level of support. And US Treasury yields have fallen in step with a global bond market rally as the trade war between China and the United States had kept recession fears on the horizon. And negative yields on government debt in countries such as Germany and Japan have also helped to depress those on US Treasuries. While yields on intermediate term Treasuries have been below the S&P 500's dividend yield for several months, the long-term 30-year yield inverted at the end of August, the first time since March 2009, when stocks bottomed to mark the start of the current bull run. The $17 trillion in negative yielding bonds have been a black hole that has sucked yields lower and lower in the US. But with the dividend yield for the S&P 500 now above that of the 30-year, investors may look to stocks with high dividends for income. And of course, remember that if a recession were to take place, stocks would decline and companies could also begin to cut dividends in an effort to conserve cash, further denting their attractiveness to investors. And the majority of economists are still expecting a recession in the US next year. A recent note from Bank of America Merrill Lynch Global Research recommended investors stick with stocks over bonds over both the short and long term, in part due to their dividend yield and relative cheapness over bonds, while also noting fewer than half of their bear market signals have been triggered. For long-term investors, valuation suggests 6% annual returns, add 2% for dividends, and this beats most fixed income offerings, they said. The euro-US dollar was down 0.03% to 1.1030, and the US dollar index futures was down 0.41% to 98.42. Bitcoin was down 2.15% on Friday to 10,577 and is down 14.07% over the past month, though is still 67.55% higher over the last year, once again underscoring its intrinsic volatility. Better trade news helped to support Eurozone bond yields through the week, and markets were fretting about whether a European Central Bank stimulus package next week could match expectations. On Wednesday, ECB policymakers appeared to dampen expectations for aggressive stimulus next week, though these comments fit into a pattern of policymakers raising expectations before dampening them in the weeks preceding a meeting to give themselves wriggle room and so not to disappoint on the day. Some think the ECB's commitment to restart the asset purchase program in September may not happen, and that this risk should be priced in. Reduced political risk from the approval of a coalition government in Italy to the UK Parliament's battle to avert a no-deal Brexit also helped to improve investors' mood in Europe, reducing demand for safe haven government bonds. The pound rose to $1.23 from the near 6-week peak of $1.2353, and it's reached that after Britain's Parliament moved to block a UK departure from the European Union without a transitional agreement. It had fallen to a three-year low of 1.19 midweek amid threats of a no-deal Brexit. The UK FTSE was up 0.15% to close at 7,282, and the financials index was up 0.58% to 730.25, and the Pan Region Stock 600 ended at 387.14. The euro was steady at 1.10 after rising 0.5% overnight, when it was helped by the Brexit drama and the sagging dollar. The 10-year German Bund rose more than one basis point to minus 0.68%, away from the record lows of minus 0.743%, which it touched on Tuesday. And other top-rated Eurozone yields also increased, although the rises were small. Italian yields, which had spiralled lower in the past week after agreements were reached with a new coalition government in Rome, steadied near their record lows. Italian bonds, which still yield far more than most European zone peers such as Spain and Portugal, have rallied as investors welcome the formation of a government that could prove to be more fiscally responsible than the last. The 10-year Italian yield was unchanged at 0.826%, which is close to the record low of 0.803%. The 5-year and 30-year Italian bond yields were also little moved in early trade. In Argentina, the latest move was to impose capital controls, which helped to calm the market, but this is not over yet. And on Thursday, Chinese Commerce Ministry said that Beijing, United States, had agreed to hold high-level trade talks in early October in Washington, easing fears that the escalating trade war will trigger a global recession. Then on Friday, Chinese central bank said it would slash the amount of cash that banks must hold as reserves, releasing a total of 900 billion yuan, or about $126 billion, in liquidity to shore up the flagging economy. But that, of course, weakens the banking system further. The Shanghai Composite Index ended up 0.46% to 2,999, and Hong Kong's Hang Seng rose 0.6%, even though the ratings agency Fitch downgraded the city's credit rating after months of unrest. So we might conclude that the recent panic in markets was excessive, and as a result, if a sustained reversal of fragile sentiment gets underway, US equities will test fresh record highs, and there will be a corresponding drop in bond prices and safe haven commodities such as gold. But markets are fickle and could turn again in the days ahead. Hi, it's Liz Interruption. But if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And now let's look at Australia, where this week the economic data came thick and fast. We released our mortgage stress data for August, where for the first time since 2015, the overall level of mortgage stress did not rise significantly. That said, the proportion of households whose cash flow is under pressure when servicing their mortgages remains elevated at 32.1% of borrowing households. This is still a record high, and average household debt-to-income ratios continue to rise, reaching 189.7 according to recent RBA data. See our post, Mortgage Stress Held Steady in August 2019. Retail turnover data on Tuesday was also weak, with the ABS reporting a fall of 0.1% in July, seasonally adjusted, following a rise of 0.4% in June, while the trend estimate for Australian retail turnover rose 0.1% in July, following a 0.2% rise in June. Compared to July 2018, the trend estimate rose 2.4%. In seasonally adjusted terms, there were falls in Queensland, down 0.2%, New South Wales, down 0.1%, South Australia, down 0.5%, Victoria, down 0.1%, the Australian Capital Territory, down 0.5%, and Tasmania, down 0.1%. But there were rises in Western Australia, up 0.6%, and the Northern Territory, up 0.3%. In conclusion, then, households are just not spending. And this was confirmed in our release of the Household Financial Confidence Index, which came in 85.45, compared with 85.43 last month, but still well below the 87.69 back in 2015. And those lows are significantly below the neutral setting. Within the property segments, owner-occupied borrowers are a little more confident this month as the mortgage interest rate cuts work through, but property investors are still well below the property inactive group as rental streams are easing back and values of high-rise apartments in particular are being questioned thanks to the recent coverage of faulty construction and flammable cladding. In most centres, those seeking to rent have more choice and lower rental options than a couple of years back. And we discussed this in our post, Household Financial Confidence Firms a Tad. We also had the trade data, and Australia recorded the first surplus in 44 years. That's the largest quarterly goods and services surplus on record at $19.9 billion, and a narrowing net income deficit to $13.9 billion contributed to Australia recording a season-adjusted $5.9 billion current account surplus for the June quarter 2019. But it's a story based on slowing imports and export prices supported by a high and now falling iron ore price. The RBA, of course, held the cash rate, but we expect more cuts ahead. They said it is reasonable to expect that an extended period of low interest rates will be required in Australia to make progress in reducing unemployment and achieve more assured progress towards the inflation target. The board will continue to monitor developments, including in the labour market, and ease monetary policy further if needed to support sustainable growth in the economy and the achievement of the inflation target over time. The market has two or three more cuts in the months ahead, and ANZ said, we now expect the cash rate to fall another 75 basis points to 0.25% by mid-2020 as the growth slowdown flows through to the labour market and the RBA responds. That will kill savers some more. Then we had the GDP result, which, though better than expected, really turned the spotlight on households as their savings ratio fell, their consumption was weak, and income growth was nowhere in real terms. In fact, in separately released data from the RBA on real household disposable income, the HDI, which is derived from the June quarter national accounts, real per capita HDI fell by 1% over the year. Some of this was thanks to higher taxes. So while exports and government spending helped to support the result, the net result was 0.4% in trend terms or 0.5% in season-adjusted terms, giving an annual growth rate of 1.4%. This is a sharp loss of momentum from 3.1% a year ago, and this pace is below that of population growth and is the slowest pace since the GFC back in September 2009. The RBA statement on monetary policy for August forecast growth of 1.7% for the year to June 2019, so the results suggest the RBA will not reach their 2019 and 2020 growth forecasts. Once again, they look wildly optimistic to achieve the RBA's forecast of 2.5% growth for 2019. The second half of 2019 will need to register growth of 1.6% or more than 3% annualised. That now seems out of reach and makes the assumption of a leap to 2.75% in 2020 more stupid than brave. More recent data on retail and residential building activity was flagged, and that means more weakness ahead. Worse, the GDP per capita data was flat in the June quarter, meaning that any growth was driven by more people coming into the country, not more productivity. Both GDP and consumer spending contracted over the year in per capita terms. So, why so weak? Well, the Australian economy is travelling through a sustained patch of cyclical weakness centred on construction, particularly housing, after a tightening of lending standards. Beyond that, there are powerful structural headwinds emanating from weak wages growth and productivity, which is slowing consumer spending. And we discussed all of this in our post GDP tanks, so what next? And there was some amazingly misleading reporting in the media about these results, with claims of a strong economy, the need to look through one weak quarter as the two rate cuts and tax refunds come through, and even in the AFR, an idiotic claim that household incomes were rising. A mix of high resource prices and high wages have helped Australia dig itself out of an income recession and reach a record standard of living as measured by disposable income per person. But the problem is this temporary jump in iron ore prices has boosted national income. but it has not flowed on to workers' pay. Real household disposable income per capita has fallen 0.5% over the past 7 years. The latest data from the RBA chart pack tells the story. Clearly, there's an attempt by some in the media to spruik despite the facts. This is shameful, but to be expected given the relationships which now exist between media and real estate. And the AFR did a piece on DFA, which was a myopic piece of reporting compared to the interview I gave, preferring to focus on my shirt rather than my data. Just shameful. But then I take it as a badge of honour that our work is getting noticed. In fact, in the past couple of years, as well as mortgage stress, poor quality construction, the war on cash, the enforcement of electronic payments, poor quality lending, and bank bail-in, we've continually come back to the cultural and behavioural norms which are corrupting the system. As a result, households are being taken to the cleaners to the benefit of the big end of town. This may not be popular, but it's a truth that needs to be told in the interests of the people. And on that note, John Adams and I discussed his newly released post summing up the current state of play. See our post on IOTP, Be Aware of Australia's Soviet Liberal Government. I urge you to watch that show and also the discussion I had with Robbie Barwick on DFA, The Cash Ban is Communism for Banks, where we revealed that more than 4,000 submissions had likely been made in that two-week window when the cash restriction bill was out for comment. And we await developments as we resist the urge to remove more of our civil liberties. And also this week, in a busy media week, I was interviewed by the ABC, first for a story which went to air about the issues relating to the faults in many high-rise buildings. The total impact could be more than $1 trillion.
But there's no imminent solution to the highly publicised issues with quality.
Well, if you want to buy a unit, buy an old unit, 20, 30, 40 years old. Don't buy a new one.
Analyst Martin North sees the problems only beginning.
This could be many billions, even $1 trillion worth of damage if you take the value collapse as well as the cost of repair.
And for another ABC piece coming up soon. I also appeared on Peter Switcher's new property web channel, where I had a chance to put my views forward.
You know, I can't run away from the question. I have to start off with this. You once predicted a 40% fall in house prices. What's happened to that, and is it something that might come again?
Yeah, it's a good question, Peter. And look, you know, the headline, of course, always belies the detail, which is that there were a number of different scenarios that I always ran.
Yep.
And the 40% fall was predicated on a global crash. Mm. And that then coming over the top and basically hitting Australia. Frankly, that is still one of my scenarios. And if you look at what's happening with the trade issues with China and the US, if you look at Brexit, if you look at the slowdown in China, I mean, there's a whole long litany of things that I could talk to in terms of, in the worst case, that is still out there. The question, of course, how likely is it? And, you know, 70% of economists in the US are still predicting a recession next year. Here in the US. So that is still a live scenario. It's not the only scenario that I've run. And at the other end, you know, if in fact the RBA is right, and if in fact we don't get any of that international disruption, then I said and continue to say that there's still some potential upside for property prices. Not a lot, but a little. And I suspect the truth lies somewhere in between those two points.
Plus the monthly Nugget News update with Alex, where we chew over the latest data. And yesterday I recorded a podcast for The Australian with the REA's Nerida Conisbee in discussion with Adam Crichton, coming soon. And that's apart from the DFA dailies. The property price data continues to show a patchy recovery, but again on low transaction volumes. The auction clearance rate from CoreLogic was 70%, compared with 74% the previous week. CoreLogic said that last week there were 1,615 capital city homes auctioned, increasing from the week prior when 1,415 auctions took place. The higher activity saw the final auction clearance rate ease to 70%, down from the week prior when it was 74.2%. Capital city homes sold at auction. Year on year, volumes continue to trend lower each week. However, last week's volumes were down only 7.6% on the same week last year, while clearance rates are tracking around 15 to 20 percentage points higher each week. Melbourne returned a final auction clearance rate above 70% for the sixth consecutive week last week, while Sydney was above 70% for its ninth consecutive week. We also see more properties being listed, so it will be interesting to see how this impacts the volumes and rates in the weeks ahead. The bull trap potentially is still in play. And CoreLogic Index also tracks a little higher. So looking at the annual movements based on the CoreLogic series, we can see that prices in Sydney are continuing to move sharply higher, and the same is true in Melbourne. We can see that in Brisbane things are not going the same way at all, and Adelaide is also drifting sideways, while Perth is continuing to fall, although the five cities average is a little higher this week. Looking at the individual movements across the main centres based on data to the 5th of September, we can see that Sydney rose 0.38% in the last week, rose 2.07% over the last quarter, fell 0.68% over the last year, and is down 13.3% from peak. In Melbourne, they rose 0.34% over the last week, they rose 2.1% over the last quarter, they fell 0.5% over the last year, and they're down 9.4% from peak. In Brisbane, they rose 0.01% over the last week, they were flat over the quarter, they fell 2% over the last year, and are down 2.2% from peak. In Adelaide, they rose 0.02% over the last week, they've fallen 0.99% over the last quarter, they've fallen 1.1% over the last year, and from peak they're down 1.5%. Perth rose 0.05% over the week, but they're down 1.71% over the quarter, down 8.8% over the last year, and down a massive 20.7% from peak. And across the major five, they were up 0.27% over the last week, up 1.23% over the last quarter, down 5.9% over the last year, and down 9.7% from peak. Once again, it's worth stressing, these averages do not tell the true story down to individual postcodes and properties. And the real question, of course, is what's ahead? As Shane Oliver said this week, talk of a recession remains all the rage, and economists don't have a great track record in predicting recessions globally, with an IMF study finding that of 153 recessions seen in 63 countries around the world between 1992 and 2014, economic forecasters only predicted five in April of the year before they started. So why would they pick this one? And he concluded, our assessment remains that growth will remain soft and that the RBA will have to provide more stimulus by taking the cash rate to around 0.5% and possibly consider unconventional monetary policy like quantitative easing. Ideally, the latter should be combined with fiscal stimulus, which should be fairer and more effective. While Australian growth is going through a rough patch with likely further to go, recession remains unlikely, barring a significant global downturn. And I think that's the point. If globally things stay where they are or improve, then Australia might well muddle on with very low rates and unconventional monetary policy. But if a global recession does come on, then things will get so much worse. And this is why I run a bunch of different scenarios in my core market model. In the best case, property prices a little higher in the next couple of years through to a substantial fall. And I also weight each scenario based on my assessment of its likelihood. Now, this approach is more appropriate given the uncertainties and vagaries in the system, but it seems that this confuses the media, who want a shocking but simple story. It's just that real life is way more complex, and that's what our modelling is trying to do. And I fear that the risks of a global downturn are still elevated, in which case, compared to a decade or so ago, we are worse placed. In 2006-07, we had positive household income growth, a substantial surplus, and interest rates were high enough to allow them to cut by more than 4%. Today, none of that is true, so there is a target on the Australian economy. My final point is the APRA loosening of lending standards was precisely the wrong approach, because as rates are cut, lending will run away, and asset prices, both stocks and houses, may well rise in value, but artificially so. And remember that on an absolute basis, property prices are currently around 40% over their fair market value, which suggests there is still trouble ahead if that credit crunch does come. The ASX 100 rose 0.15% to end at 5,506. The financials index rose 0.76% to end at 6,295. And the local volatility index fell 4.28% to end at 1308. ANZ rose 0.71% to 2707. CBA rose 0.37% to 79.54. NAB rose 0.87% to 27.75. And Westpac rose 0.49% to 28.63 after more class action news this week. Bank of Queensland rose 1.21% to 9.20. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank rose 0.83% to 10.98. And Suncorp rose 0.44% to 13.74. Macquarie rose 1.45% to 127.08. And AMP was up 5.42% to 175. Lenders mortgage insurer Genworth was up 2.57% to 3.19. McGrath, the real estate agent group, was down 10.87% to 20.5 cents. And Yellow Brick Road was up 1.45% to 7 cents. AFG fell 2.67% to 2.19. Mortgage Choice fell 0.45% to 1.09. And the Australian US dollar rose 0.51% to 68.48. The euro Aussie dollar cross was down 0.49% to 1.6106. And the gold Aussie cross was down 1.30% to 2200.48. And the Bitcoin Aussie cross was down 3.66% to 15,181. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again.